This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Blessing Adereogba in Lagos. And here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. Why is Namibia facing such high levels of unemployment? Young Namibians have been telling us why they think things are going wrong.
To many places I give my CV, but there is no one who's calling me.
We have a lot of jobs here available, but HR, when you go to a company, apply for a job, you don't need to pay somebody to get a job. That's why we are struggling. That's why we are selling drugs and those things to survive.
And how is the conflict in the Eastern DRC worsening health risk and raising fears of disease outbreaks?
In my letter to our African head of state and government, I told them, if bullet cannot kill you, outbreaks will kill all of us.
It's Tuesday, the 4th of February. First, we go to South Africa. President Donald Trump and Elon Musk have been trending on social media. Why? Mr. Trump wrote on his social media platform Truth Social, "I will be cutting off all future funding to South Africa until a full investigation of the situation has been completed." Elon Musk, who was born in South Africa and is now a powerful Trump advisor, joined in the debate. What exactly were they reacting to? South Africa President Cyril Ramaphosa recently updated the law that allows for government to take over private land or property for the benefit of the public. So, say they want to build a bridge and the land your house is on is needed for it, then government could take over the land, but it has to pay you for it. It's all in the constitution. As President Ramaphosa politely pointed out on social media in response to President Trump. But as it's often the case with social media, not everyone follows the details too closely. The upgrades to that law sparked fear and controversy because land ownership is a sore point in South Africa. Let's just say much of it is in the hands of white South Africans. Black South Africans, by far the majority population, owns very little of it due to a system called apartheid. The system ended when Nelson Mandela became the first democratically elected president of South Africa in 1994. Part of the promise of democracy was that resources like land will be distributed to those whose land was stolen from them. It hasn't happened yet. But, and this is important, the updated land expropriation law is not directly part of the process of giving land to the landless. So, what exactly is the land expropriation law about? And are, to quote President Trump, are certain classes of people being treated very badly because of it? Wandile Siljobo is a South African economist. Let's find out together.
The expropriation law is not directly related to land reform in South Africa. Every country in the world does have an expropriation bill. The United States has an expropriation law. Expropriation law is generally used if the governments want to build hospitals, highway, bridges, you name it, so that they have a way at which, if the owners of that land are not reaching an agreement with the government about buying the land, they have other means that are fair and, of course, led by the judiciary and how to facilitate that. South Africa has an Expropriation Act, but it dates back from 1975. This time around, it had to be updated to align with the current constitution of the Republic of South Africa in the democratic era. The only change this time around that is significant is the fact that the Act does provide that there may be instances at which the South African judiciary can agree that there must be a nil compensation for particular pieces of land. And of course, whatever happens, that must still be just and equitable and under the current constitution.
Okay, so what's the difference between the law before and what has changed now? What exactly has changed?
Now there could be expropriation done for public interest. And the other new possibility, which has gotten a lot of people worked out, is this issue that there is now a provision which say there may be a nil compensation or zero compensation. But this is under the extreme scenario. And even if it does reach to that level, it's not something that a government would arbitrarily do. It has, the courts have to look into that and decide if that's what must happen or not. And I mean, they have to comply with roughly over 200 pieces of legislation to get to that. And I think the other important thing to stress is the fact that Expropriation Act is not a policy of driving land reform or anything. It's something that gets used as a last resort. The land reform process in South Africa is still under three pillars, which is the land restitution, where people can say a certain pieces of land were taken away by the apartheid government from their families. And then under such scenario, there's investigations that do get to happen. And those people are either compensated from the public purse, the public funds, or the state buys the land back from those that are currently own it now and then give it back to people. So the South African government still buys land from the open market. A second pillar is land redistribution, which the African government goes out there, buy land on the open market and distribute it to Black South Africans. And of course, land tenure, which talks to this idea that there are pieces of land in South Africa which were under tribal authority and Black South Africans don't have title deeds on that. And it's really strengthening and doing up that. So the land reform process in South Africa has not changed. The Section 25 of the South African Constitution is the one that guarantees every individual the rights and the protection of property rights. And that has not been amended. And I think people conflate the discussion that the ANC had brought forward in 2017 about the need to amend the constitution with this discussion. And we know that as a country, we had that conversation and we all came to the realization that it was not necessary and it was unhelpful. And we are not in that conversation today.
So are there certain people who are being targeted or is it just anyone?
No, there's no one that is targeted. Let's say now the South African government wants to build a bridge. And the president owns a certain land that is in a place where they have to build a bridge or a highway. Even him, he can be expropriated of that, and therefore, and then he will be compensated by the value of what that land is worth. And then they can build those things. And remember, all of this happens on things that are for public interest. Either it's a dam, it's a school, it's a clinic and stuff like that. There's no one person that is categorized. And I know that there's been a discussion that it targets white South Africans and all of that. That is completely untrue.
So why is it controversial? Why do some find this law controversial?
It is not as controversial because even the Democratic Alliance, which is the opposing party or the minority party before the GNU, they've just issued a statement calling on this misunderstanding of the expropriation bill following President Trump's comments. And they are saying, look, this is not what's happening in South Africa. So most South Africans have actually been writing a lot of pieces today clarifying. The people that are misunderstanding are the people outside South Africa, not those that are in South Africa.
Okay, now let's talk about the process. What will the process be like for a landowner like myself? Would I get notified a few months ahead? What's the process like?
Look, the process is that no one is coming for anybody's land. So as things stand, if you owned a certain piece of land last year or last week and you're still finding things are fine, I like that. The bill says under extreme circumstances, when there is something that needs to be done for the benefit of public good. How many times do countries have to build big dams or highway or all of those things? Very few times, because the infrastructure in South Africa already exists. So we are not actually building infrastructure everywhere where now we can actually say, okay, there will be people coming into other people's pieces of land. That's not what's happening. No one is coming for anybody's land.
Now, let's talk about Donald Trump, the President Trump, and Elon Musk comment and the comments about mistreatment of people regarding the land issue. What do you have to say about that?
I mean, the only thing I would say the comments are actually distorting the reality of what's happening in South Africa. I'm a resident of this, I'm a citizen of this country and stay here. And there is no mistreatment that I do see, to be honest with you, which is exactly what all South Africans have been saying today. If you read South African media, you realize that black, white, Indian, mixed race, all people have been actually at pains to clarify that there is no such thing in South Africa.
So why do you think America, you know, did care about this conversation? And does America's threat to withdraw funding from South Africa hold any significant bargaining power for the landowners who may be affected?
As best as I can tell, no. Remember, South Africa doesn't receive that much aid for a whole range of things. That's the program that is related to HIV. And within the agricultural sector and the others, not much. What's more important is the trade relation, the investment opportunities, and the relationships that the countries do have. And I think that the dialogue and the focus domestically is about how do you mend and clarify the miscommunication and the misrepresentation that each of the parties may actually be having about what's happening here in the country. And I think that's what many people are focused on right now.
What do you think Donald Trump is missing or getting wrong with his statement on Twitter, and why a lot of people are getting confused?
Yeah, I think there's a general thinking that the Expropriation Act is targeting white South Africans, but that's not the case. The laws apply to all citizens of a country. And I do think also there is a confusion between Expropriation Act and land reform in South Africa. Expropriation Act is one of the pieces of legislation that could be used under extreme circumstances, which we don't foresee in the foreseeable future. It's not something that could be an everyday driver of land reform. And even if you do apply the Expropriation Act, it's not the government that you'd unilaterally make some of these decisions. He has to go through the processes of the court. And I think President Trump may be missing some of that nuance. In terms of land reform in South Africa is still continuing under the open market principles, where the state buy land from private citizens who are willing to sell. We even call it willing buyer, willing seller approach. And once the state has bought that land, it then distributes to black South Africans.
Wandile Sishlobo, South African economist. The Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, popularly known as Africa CDC, is sounding the alarm that a conflict in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo is putting millions at risk by crippling health systems and allowing deadly diseases to spread unchecked. Goma, the city now controlled by the Rwandan-backed M23 rebels, was the epicenter of the mpox virus in 2024. That outbreak spread to 21 African countries and killed over 500 people, prompting the WHO, World Health Organization, to declare it a public emergency. Now, with hospitals overwhelmed, power outages, and a shortage of medical supplies, experts fear a resurgence, not just of mpox, but also of measles and cholera. So, what does this mean for people on the ground, and how bad could it get? Dr. Jean Kaseya, the Director General for the Africa CDC, has been telling me why the African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is worried.
We are talking about Goma, that is home of 3 million people, including 1 million that are displaced. And these people are living in an area of 75 square kilometers. It means we are talking about an area where the density, the population density is 36,920 people per square kilometer, the highest one in the world. And this one, without access to basic services like water, sanitation, hygiene, without access to medical infrastructures, and we also have a shortage of human resources, lack of medicines, and to worsen the situation, we have
ongoing outbreaks in this area: mpox, measles, cholera, and all of that killed more than 3,000 children in 2024. Goma is also the epicenter of the clade 1B of mpox. That is the most deadly clade of mpox that pushed me also to declare mpox as public health emergency for Kondal security. Putting everything together, we are sitting in a bomb.
How is the health service doing in Eastern DRC at the moment with the conflict in DRC?
We are experiencing so many challenges. The first one is the health infrastructures are damaged. It means people, they cannot have access to hospitals and health centers. The second one is human resources. It means health workers who are dedicated to provide support. They have to either move out of Goma or to hide themselves. The third one is lack of medicines and vaccines. For instance, we got 3 million doses of mpox vaccine from Japan called LC16. These 3 million doses landed to Kinshasa, but it was mostly to be used in Goma and other parts of the eastern DRC. Now, I'm looking for opportunity. I'm calling head of state and leaders to give me opportunity to bring these vaccines to Goma.
So what outbreaks are we at risk here?
Mpox, we are talking about cholera. You have to know that cholera is currently affecting a number of African countries. But in Goma, cholera is affecting a number of children and even adults. We are talking about measles killing thousands of children. But you know, we are talking mostly about diseases that have the possibility to mutate. And when this virus will mutate, this is how we got COVID. People, they try to forget this lesson. I think we are having this risk of so many outbreaks ongoing and potentially new outbreaks that will come from there. And if we don't have access to these people, I want to fly to Goma. I want to bring vaccines. What I need is security for my team, security for people who must get this vaccine.
Before now, what has been put in place in terms of prevention and treatment that's before this latest escalation?
What we did in this region, as Africa CDC, we supported to build the laboratory. This is the second referral laboratory in DRC. The first one is in Kinshasa, the second one in Goma. We managed also to build capacities of health workers. We managed to secure a number of vaccines and medicines, and we managed to provide support to build health infrastructures. This is what we did before this current outbreak. But with what is going on, almost everything is down.
Okay, your team wants to help send vaccines. So what exactly is the roadblock? What are the conversations between your team and the authorities in DRC?
We have our diplomatic channel to communicate with all countries in Africa. And I have support from the African Union Commission. I have the support from the president of Mauritania, who is leading African Union currently. We are engaging all countries. You know, the situation changed. And we need to see how we can get a direct flight from Kinshasa to Goma and to bring vaccines there.
So should there be a collapse, you know, what happens? Like for mpox, you know, if the disease travels quite fast, you know, what could be the risk to other nations?
If we talk about mpox, in April, mpox was only in 6 countries. I'm talking about April 2024. In August, when I declared mpox public health emergency of continental security, it moved from 6 to 13 countries. Currently, we are talking mpox is in 21 African countries. You see, in a few months, how mpox managed to move from 6 to 21 countries. But this one, it's because we are also controlling the situation. We are providing you support to African countries. But when you have situation like what we are experiencing, not only in Goma, because I'm informed that it's also South Kivu that will be affected, it means we are losing control over the management of this outbreak and knowing that this region is the epicenter of this outbreak. This is a concrete example on how an outbreak, when you have insecurity, can become a disaster for not only the country, but for the continent. In my letter to our African head of state and government, I told them, if bullet cannot kill you, outbreaks will kill all of us. When you have this kind of conflict and you don't bring the public health aspect, it means the way we are analyzing the conflict is not complete.
So what do we need to do now? What needs to be done urgently to prevent the worst?
First is to give Africa CDC full access, not only to people, but also to what we call medical countermeasures. It means medicine vaccines, like what I was talking, how to bring vaccines from Kinshasa to Goma. Second, to establish conditions for people to come to have access to the support we are providing. Third is to think to provide basic services to people. They need water, they need electricity, they need sanitation, they need hygiene. We need to provide these services to the population. This is what we can do for now.
Dr. John Kaseya is the Director General for the Africa CDC, a summit between the East African Community and the Southern African Development Community is expected to happen in Tanzania over the weekend and will bring together presidents of the DRC and Rwanda in an attempt to address the crisis in the Congo. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. How does it feel to be without a job or knowing that your skills don't match the job market? Frustrating, right? That's the reality for many Namibians today.
When I came here, I get a job. But now, the people, they passed away. 2021, Corona, from there, I did not get a job until now. To many places, I give my CV, but there's no one who's calling me. To get a job here in Swakopmund, you must know someone. Even if in that place, they are looking for people, even if you go there and give your CV, they will not, unless you must know someone who's working there, then he will make you a way, then you can get that job.
We have a lot of jobs here available, né? But HR, when you go to a company, apply, né? For a job, you don't need to pay somebody to get a job. You understand? A lot of people are educated. They have papers, né? But they don't get the jobs. Why? Because they are bringing their friends and children and those things.
They are just having that corruption, né?
Yeah.
For paying. There's a space for people. Mm. Maybe 10 people. They are looking for 10 people. Mm. But you to get that job,
you must pay. So how will I get the money first to pay to get the job?
Where am I going to get the money? Why I don't work? I don't have nothing.
You get my point now?
So now?
That's why we are struggling. That's why we are selling drugs and those things to survive every day.
I'm not working. I'm struggling as a woman. I got two kids, what I'm feeding. So I have to go to town to go in.
She must make a plan.
I sell myself as a prostitute. Like now, as I'm talking now, I don't even have food. But I'm struggling through the prostitute work.
Namibia, a southern African country with a population of about 3 million, is facing a rising unemployment crisis. The Namibia Statistics Agency recently released its labor force survey, revealing a sharp increase in unemployment. The official unemployment rate, which stood at 19.8% in 2018, surged to 36.9% in 2023. Meanwhile, broad unemployment rose from 33% and is now nearly a staggering 55%. What's behind these shocking numbers? Thimani Kani Umbodo has been explaining. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Foster Digital Education, operating in media, marketing and education.
Namibia has always faced a relatively high unemployment rate, especially for a small country with a population of 3 million people. But I think the most important thing for anyone to take away about Namibia is an unemployment issue is that it's structural in nature and not cyclical. So, you know, like most other countries, we have our cyclical issues, which is, for example, when you go through recessions or with the COVID pandemic. But those are sort of just accelerants. With Namibia, we're very reliant on, for example, our mining industries. They contribute quite a lot to our GDP. These are capital intensive and not necessarily high employment industries. And so it's a bunch of structural factors that have gotten worse over time. And I think that's why we are where we are.
You said structural issue, that it's more of a structural issue. I need you to explain more on it.
Okay. So the first one would be the over-reliance on our extractive sectors, which is mining. They contribute what I'd say is a disproportionate portion of our GDP in the sense that you have a small, highly skilled labor force that's contributing aggressively to our GDP. And then those industries that we rely heavily on as a country are capital intensive as opposed to labor intensive. And so a lot of machinery, not too many people. And that's just how our economy is structured because we have a lot of resources like uranium, diamonds, gold, and the works. And so it's really an issue of a lack of diversification. We also have a severe mismatch between our education system and what the job market demands. So you have many graduates that leave school with qualifications that don't align with the available jobs. Meanwhile, the industries need workers and are struggling to find them. So you have that mismatch. And then you also have a business environment that's unnecessarily difficult in Namibia. So, you know, naturally for a small country with about 3 million people, our labor force is not the most attractive to large corporations. So when you look at it from that perspective, then your national policy as a country should be aggressively pro-business in order to bring companies in. But instead, we have high business costs, complex regulations that also discourage local entrepreneurs and foreign investors alike. I think the last structural issue that I'd mention is you ask anyone about Namibia and they'll tell you we're a very peaceful country, right? The reason for that is we have a very large informal sector, which absorbs a lot of the labor that isn't absorbed by, you know, the formal labor markets. But there's limited growth for that informal sector because it faces challenges like limited access to capital, regulatory barriers, and it's not really being formalized.
Okay, so what do we have mostly in Namibia? Is it a case where people are creating jobs for themselves or a case where the government is creating jobs for people?
It's such a mixed economy, right? So when you mention government, government is one of the largest employers naturally in any country, in any economy. But then between 2016 and 2019, we had a recession. So even before COVID, as a country, we were facing some economic challenges. And one of the reasons was a pullback in government spending because government debt had gotten quite high. And so in an attempt to reel it in, they slowed down government spending. So on that front, that also reduced the amount of jobs that government was creating as a significant creator of employment in Namibia. It's not to say that government is the only creator. So like I said, we have a very, very large informal market of people that are self-employed or very small companies that employ one or two people, but really, really at scale. So you have a lot of them. And those people are also facing their own challenges. But you also have the formalized big employers, like we have a very big financial services sector.
Okay, let's talk about the people. Who are the target group mostly affected? What's the target age group mostly affected by this unemployment?
It's bad across the board. It's always been higher among the youth, slightly higher. So I haven't looked at the updated youth unemployment figure. I think it's maybe percentage-wise, it may be somewhere the broad, maybe around 60. But prior to that, it was 46.1%. So youth has always been slightly higher. But as a whole, across the board, no one age group is exempt from a difficult environment like that. There's no particular demographic that's harder hit. There's slight variations, but across the board, it's a bad situation.
All that you've said, what can be done about this?
As a business owner, I'm not an economist. I won't claim to have some all-encompassing solution. But what I can say is, from a business perspective, I think the low-hanging fruit that needs to happen, which is making Namibia extremely pro-business. That's what I've seen work. That's what I understand. And globally, again, that is the approach to solving unemployment. An approach that's too government-centric or where government tries to do everything has never worked. So it's a thing of pro-business policy. And I think because the numbers are so severe, it may do an injustice to the Namibian government and their recognition of the issues that are planned. So a lot of the pro-business stuff is happening. It just needs to be accelerated. And there has to be a national policy that focuses on entrepreneurship at scale, focuses on investor and their rights and protecting them when they come into Namibia, and also just focuses on funding the informal sectors. But now that it's become front page news everywhere, there's sort of an air of crisis that's solidified. And I think there's now going to be a sense of urgency in looking at solutions.
Phimani Kani Mbodo, the CEO of Foster Digital Education in Namibia. Focus on Africa was put together by Franny Joey and Charles Gitonga in Nairobi, Victor Silva and Nyasha Michelle in London. Paul Bachibinga was the senior producer in charge, and Francesca Dunn was the technical producer. Andrew Lombard and Alice Muthengi are editors. I'm Blessing Adiroba. Thanks for listening.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.